Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In this segment, we have the honor and the privilege of interviewing Mr. Seth Law. He is the founder and principal security consultant of Redpoint Security, a major cybersecurity firm based out of Salt Lake City, Utah. Seth, thank you for your time this afternoon, and let's go ahead and get started.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me, Robbie. I'm excited to be here talk security.
Let's have some fun and talk about cybersecurity. That's what we're passionate about. We did all kinds of not background checks, obviously, but I did a lot of Google searching, and I saw your LinkedIn profile, saw your website. Can you tell me what is your background? I mean, you're a software developer by training, I believe, if I'm correct. But tell us about your whole background. I'm really interested, and I think our audience would be too.
Yeah, for sure. I have a degree in computer science. Right? That's where I started, actually, at Utah State University. I've got a degree from computer science, but I actually started working in the field as a developer and system administrator before I actually graduated from school. I was fully employed at iOmega. If you remember the zip drive people, the zip and jazz drives that were popular back in, it was the late 90s, early 2000s. They were a pretty big company at that time. And I did development for them, so Java development, also some system administration. It was almost pre-DevOps style work that I did for them for a period of time, and got into security while I was there, managing their firewalls, making sure that they, people could push code to production, and automated that whole system for them and their website at the time. And so I got really involved with Java and Perl, and those were kind of the two main languages that we were using there. If I go back further than that, I actually worked at a Mac reseller way back in the day who did Progress development is what the name of the language was. I mean, that was like the whole factory automation tool that was supposedly a 4GL. Anyway, so that's where I started. I moved from there into a strict security role at Zions Bank, where I helped build their penetration testing program. So this is before, we really had anything outside of maybe a little bit of IDS, like intrusion detection systems, some firewalls, and we were starting to test applications and networks on a lower level for security flaws and security vulnerabilities. But I used my development background to actually help drive that program and build that out. Initially, in security, when it first came up, I was more of everybody was a generalist because you had to do everything from network to applications to, monitoring. It was, you were just the security guy. But then as we built that penetration testing program at Zions Bank out in Salt Lake City, we started to specialize. So we did more of, I started to get more back into the application side of things because that's my background, right? I know how to build applications. I've done, web development. I've done client-side development for a number of years. And so that's where it moved from there. And then that took me from development back to security, also kind of back to application security, and I bounced back and forth between firms, so working directly for a bank or a large financial institution to consulting and so forth. So I went from there to Fishnet Security and back and forth, and then started my own thing a couple of years ago, started Redpoint Security instead.
Okay. So can you elaborate further on your career in security? Do you have any certifications like a CISSP or any programming certifications?
Oh, yeah, for sure. When I did end up doing my CISSP, that was kind of the first, security certification that popped up that was interesting to me back when I was at Zions. I did get my GSEC at one point from SANS as well. The SANS program was taking off. And then also my OSCP when I was working with Fishnet. So those were kind of the ones that I started with. I also have my CSSLP certified software security lifecycle professional, right? That one. And since then, I've kind of maintained those, and I'll get like AWS certifications, like their general security certification or whatever, as it pops up and there's other things that I'm interested in. But the, you know, the main certs were the, you know, the CISP and the OSCP, which is one of those that I recommend to anybody getting into the industry, just because it is such a hands-on practical certification for what an analyst or a penetration tester does, how to actually exploit systems and go about assessing them. It's a really great one. I have dabbled a little bit on the CEH side. I never got that certification. The OSCP was always more interesting to me than how the CEH went about it. But I know there's people that go that route as well. So my security background. So like I said, I started building that Zions penetration testing team. From there, I went to Fishnet Security as an application security consultant. So at that point, I really cut my teeth on a wide variety of applications and verticals. So everything from healthcare, I've been in banking before, to tech. I did a lot of work for eBay at one point through Fishnet Security, to small mom and pop shops that would come in. Fishnet was a really big player a few years ago before they got acquired, or before they merged with Accuvant and they formed Optiv. They kind of got bought out and formed a huge security services / VAR company that is Optiv today. And I still know a bunch of people from that time. But that's where it really started. At that time as well, I spoke at Black Hat. I did, you know, the initial talk, we were actually pushing the needle on response analysis and testing applications, like the response testing as things were coming back with Nathan Hamill. So we did a talk there. I think this would have been like 2011, if I remember right. And then in 2012, me and Justin Angler released a framework called Sierra, which was an iOS rapid assessment tool for applications that were coming out at that time. So mobile assessments were really hot back then. I mean, nobody else was looking at those applications as iOS and Android were popping up. Justin and I were fairly familiar with iOS and how applications were built. And so we built a little framework to actually assess those applications, look at things like data encryption, data at rest, what was being stored on those devices, and how secure they actually were. Obviously, that platform has come a long way since then, but it was one of the initial talks on how to go about, you know, assessing mobile applications. So that was kind of like my first experience with Black Hat and DEF CON and speaking there. I mean, I've been going to Black Hat and DEF CON since they were small conferences. Nowadays, they're huge. Moved from there I was still doing application security, but I popped back into a firm for a couple of years, early warning services that actually does fraud analytics. And they're now the back end for Zelle, if anyone's heard of them, but helped. I was their principal security security architect for a couple of years before I went back into consulting. Did that full time as a head of R&D for a smaller consulting firm for that was about 4 years before I formed Redpoint Security. So my pathway seems to wander back and forth between being embedded in an organization and helping large organizations build security programs to being a consultant and looking at applications on a smaller scale where it's very targeted for 2 or 3 weeks where I look at something and we make some assessments on it, or we're looking at the source code that's associated with it. And then, handing off a report, working with developers to secure that code.
Okay, cool. Sounds awesome. So you got one awesome background there. Now let's go to your company, Redpoint Security. What is it and how did you get the name Redpoint Security?
So Redpoint actually came from my college days. I used to be a rock climber. We still go rock climbing once in a while. But Redpoint's actually a climbing term for a sport climb that you do that is you're able to get up the mountain, like get up to the top, complete the climb, without falling and without putting in the anchors as you go. So you're like the first person that's securing the climb. Other climbers can come after you, right? But that's where it comes from. It's that term red point is, hey, I'm going to red point this climb, which is I'm going to go up and secure all the anchors, put the rope up for the first time. So you're free climbing, you know, 10 to 20 feet every single time between anchors to get to put it in. So it's a little bit more dangerous than a normal, hey, a sport climb where the rope is already there because you actually have to place it as you go. So that's where the term red point comes from. So I was a climber for a number of years, and then red point security came about when me and a couple of friends were talking about forming a company a number of years ago, and I registered the domain, you know, probably 10 or 15 years ago. And then the last couple of years, it really, you know, took off. The opportunity presented itself for me to actually go independent and had contacts and gigs coming in to actually do assessment work and source code review and training work. And so that's where it actually took off. So Redpoint itself is focused on, you know, application security. I've done both research and services. The majority of what we do is application security services. That means that we are focused on code, whether that's, you know, designing an application, building the architecture for it, actually assessing that application, mobile, you know, it doesn't matter what that code is actually doing, but that's what the focus is on the code itself. Like, I know there's a lot of people that focus on like web or, you know, specific aspects of code security, right? Or like specific applications that are written and frameworks or whatever. But we pride ourselves in actually having developers on staff. The whole concept behind Redpoint Security and application security in general is that the best application security professionals are ex-developers or are developers. So we encourage people to code and actually use those experiences to assess other applications, right? So me with a Java background, I understand how Java is put together. I'm actually able to assess Java applications a lot quicker than I could, say, like a .NET or, you know, other applications that are out there. And you kind of specialize in that as a developer yourself, right? Like you go and you write Node applications. You know where the developers make mistakes with Node applications. So it's a lot more difficult to go into a new framework or a new language and be able to assess it if you haven't built something in it. So like we're taking that knowledge that we have that we've learned over the number of years in coding and building applications and flipping it on its head to actually assess those applications and help businesses secure their own presence. I know I'm wandering
sounds
a little
off.
Bit, but that's yeah.
No, that's fine. Hey, we got some time here.
Yeah.
So. But awesome. So what is, okay, now we know there are tons of cybersecurity firms out there, like in the Bay Area, probably the locations where you're at, you know, the Plain States, you know, on the down Southeast Coast. What separates Redpoint Security from the rest of the crowd? Like, why should a customer say, hey, Seth, I want to come to you versus these other 2,000-plus vendors that are out there?
Okay. Yeah. The main reason is, you know, harken back to what I'm talking about, the fact that our developers know code, or our consultants know code. There's a lot of firms that are out there that'll pop people out of, you know, I think about the big four accounting firms and kind of their model is, hey, we're going to pull people straight out of college and drop them into assessing different things, right? So you don't have the experience. We're definitely a boutique firm. And we specialize in hard problems, right? I talk to a lot of security firms. They want to perform assessments as quickly as possible, and they kind of turn into body shops almost, where it's, hey, it doesn't really matter what your skill set is. I'm going to throw you out this. Here's the way that we go about assessing an application, and you just need to turn around in 2 weeks. We're not necessarily looking at your background. We may a little bit, but most likely it's just, what can we get out as quickly as possible? We're flipping it a little bit on its head, and we're trying to target developers that have experience with those applications against the applications themselves. That gives us a couple of advantages. Number one is we're able to discover vulnerabilities quicker because we know where the developers typically make mistakes. And number two, we're able to give you better remediation advice. So if you've ever seen remediation advice that comes out of something, some sort of an automated tool, it's always very generic. And there's a reason for that. They don't know what the application looks like. They don't know what the source code itself is. And so it has to be generic. Where we have people that are looking at those problems, we're able to give you more detailed advice. We always want access to the source code. Most of the application assessments that we do involve the source at some level. But that also gives us the ability to turn around and tell you, hey, guess what? We found SQL injection in your application. This is exactly where it exists. This is the line of code. And here is patch level remediation advice that you could take and, you know, copy and paste into your code. Obviously, you still want to test that, but you can copy and paste those recommendations into your code to fix the problem itself. That is the key differentiator that we have, is the ability for our consultants to go in and actually think like developers, be developers with your source code, and give you the level of advice and talk to your developers on that level, rather than coming in as security or somebody else and telling them, hey, guess what, you messed up. Guess what, you have to go research this for the next 20 hours to figure out exactly how you messed up and where you should fix things and what the general approaches for that are. I'm not sure if that was succinct enough, but realistically it's because we're focused on security, but from a development aspect, rather than security from security view.
It sounds awesome. Now, why did you find Redpoint? Is this the passion that you've had? Obviously, you have a very deep passion for cybersecurity, but were there any other driving motivations for you to start your company and become an entrepreneur?
I've always had the desire to found my own thing and kind of control my own destiny. But realistically, it was the opportunity presented itself, and I wanted a company that could specialize in code and not go off the rails and, you know, become more of a body shop, right? Like, it's a very white glove service that we provide. There's a lot of touch as far as customer interaction. The customers that I have, the people that come to Redpoint, aren't going to come to us because we're turning around and just doing a simple compliance check, right? The boutique service and the white glove service that we provide is something that I've always been passionate about. And I saw on the flip side the frustrations that developers and, you know, organizations have, being embedded in a couple of organizations and getting reports in and not being able to actually do anything with it. So Redpoint is my opportunity to actually flip that and give more value back to the customers that are paying money for security services, and then also making the developers' lives easier. It's hard enough to churn out feature after feature and then get a 20-page report or a 40-page report from an assessment firm that comes in and says, guess what, you did everything wrong, now go fix it, without instructions. So being able to change that and to help secure businesses, applications, but also make developers' lives easier, because I'm involved in that community, has been very rewarding.
Okay, excellent. Now, what are the different offerings or product service offerings you have at Redpoint? Can you please elaborate on those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just grabbing a quick drink. So there's a number of things that we offer. We're very SDLC focused. SDLC is the software development lifecycle. Obviously, as developers, that's the process that is used to actually create applications. So it goes everything from, hey, you know, we have this idea for an application. The general advice around security within an application is that the sooner that you involve security when building an application, the actually less expensive it is to implement and to maintain. So if you involve Redpoint, you know, early in the design phase or in the architecture phase, before any lines of code has been written, we're going to be able to give you advice to secure that application and how you should go about building it. So that's one offering that's more of like a design review, a secure application design review, or a secure application architecture review. So we'll look at the design of the application, we'll look at the architecture of an application, give you pointers on what we've seen work in the past, what hasn't. You know, you're pushing into a cloud environment, whether that's Azure or AWS, we can talk to any of those, you know, GCP, and how you should be implementing your application and designing it so that it's secure in that environment, or it's like on-prem, it's your own, it's your hardware that it's being deployed on, so the architecture that underlies the application obviously affects the security of the application, and that's where that comes into play. That's kind of a secure design review, the secure architecture review of an application. And then once there's actually code to look at, we have offerings around secure code review. That's a big one that we do. That's a very difficult process. I know that there are tools that are out there that will provide automated static analysis tools, whether that's from, it's not even HP anymore. It's Micro Focus, there's Fortify, there's IBM's AppScan. It'll do some searches through code, there's Veracode. All of these different automated applications will scan code, give you a list of, you know, what they find as vulnerabilities. But on the flip side of that, the secure code review offering that we have actually gives you a better, it gives you better coverage of your application, right? There's only so much that an automated tool can do. And secure code review is a difficult proposition. Like, it's just one of those things that takes time and it takes manual effort from a developer to actually go through, understand code, and find vulnerabilities. We spend a lot of time reviewing code, and we've got an approach that we've developed over the last 15 years that works for looking at code, finding vulnerabilities, and alleviating those vulnerabilities. So that's a large majority of what we do is secure code review. Once you've actually developed the application, you feel like it's secure, then we've got kind of your traditional web application assessment or web application security assessment, application security assessment, whatever you want to call it there, where it's a black box assessment of the application itself, where we're making sure that those security controls are in place. So that's going to test everything from, hey, your cross-site scripting, you can find it in a secure code review, but we can validate that it doesn't exist within that application security assessment, or SQL injection, SSRF, any of the common vulnerabilities that are out there. There's a lot of research that's out there, and the firms call it all different, that offering itself, whether it's a web application penetration test, whether it's an application pen test, dynamic assessment, black box assessment. Those are all very similar names for it. Obviously, as developers, right, we like to have what we call a kind of a hybrid assessment between the secure code review and an application security assessment, that we marry those two together. So if a lot of firms will bring us in after the application is developed and they are running their annual penetration test, as they usually like to call it, of an application, and we ask for the code. Like, we have a hybrid application security assessment, that's what we call it, where it's more of a gray box. It's a dynamic assessment that is source assisted. So we have the source code, we're doing a source code review, we're doing an application security assessment. At the same time, we're validating all of the findings that we find in the source itself, the white box portion of the assessment, with the black box portion, and then we're able to actually give you a better understanding of your application space, like where it exists, like make sure that you're getting full complete coverage in testing the application, and then also recommendations that are that developer-focused recommendation, right? It's source code that we can fix and we can see, we can tear apart, and give you the recommendation to actually fix the vulnerabilities that we find that we validated actually exists. So that's that hybrid application security assessment. And that kind of runs the gamut. Like, I talked to hybrid, but we do support a number of different frameworks and languages. Obviously, Java and .NET are ones that we see all the time because that seems to be the the main corporate development languages at this point. We've been seeing a lot of Node applications recently. Node seems to be taking off. But everything from, you know, Rails, Ruby on Rails applications, Go application, and then anything that's in different environments as well. The approach that we take is very abstracted from the language itself. We use the language experts to assess those different frameworks and languages, but the approach is very similar, so we're able to apply that against IoT applications, right? If you've got C or C++ code that's being deployed to, you know, some device that's going out to consumers, we can look at that. Or mobile applications, obviously, you know, I wrote that framework a number of years ago, but we understand mobile applications, iOS and Android, how to assess them, and how to go about making sure that those applications are secure and they're interacting with, you know, microservices or whatever on the back end in a secure manner. And then, you know, anything else that pops up there, right? Like the same approach that we take for applications, like I don't like to just say web applications, but I say applications in general, applies across the board. So, like, really anything SDLC focused, and I didn't even get into the training stuff. There are training offerings in there as well, but that's kind of the assessment offerings that we have.
Okay. Do you have, I mean, who's your typical client that you go after? Is it small and medium sized business, or is it like the Fortune 500, or a mixture of both, or?
It's a mixture of both, right? It seems that, so I'm in Salt Lake City. I'm close to Silicon Valley. We've done quite a few kind of tech startups over the last year and a half, just because it seems like those smaller companies need the help. So I found that the smaller companies will use us more for some of the earlier cycle assessment offerings, right? So we'll get involved in architecture review, design review, and then the secure code review with those companies a lot easier. The bigger Fortune 500, mm-hmm. and we have a few of those clients as well. They typically have people on staff that are doing some of that work, and they're looking more for, hey, that annual penetration test. They've been using like somebody like Optiv or another, you know, larger provider, and they're looking for more specialized work to actually analyze those applications. So we'll jump in and we'll do more of the assessment offerings for them. So it just kind of depends on where you're at in developing your application and what is it, what you're trying to accomplish. There is an offering that's there, and there's something that we can help you do, but it really just depends on what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Okay. Do you have any like success stories you'd like to share with us? Any case studies with your clients?
Yeah, actually, the last couple of years, and I do have clearance to talk with them. So some clients don't actually want us to go out and talk about it. I've got a contact with Carvana. I'm not sure if you are familiar with Carvana. They are a kind of a newer player in the car sales space, selling used cars online. Okay? They're based out of Tempe, Arizona, so they're down there. But realistically, what it is they've got a mobile application that they provide to users that the users can browse the application. They can pick out a car, and they can have the car either delivered to them, or the user can go to one of their auto vending machines and pick up the car and drive it home, right? So the whole idea is the car buying experience is built within this mobile application. So you can log in, you can actually, you know, apply for a loan, you can be, you know, qualified, you can track delivery of your car, you can pick out the car, but you're providing a whole bunch of sensitive information, right? You think about applying for a loan in a mobile application, there's a lot of personal data that goes into that loan process. So it makes it easy and it's more convenient for the consumer to actually purchase a car this way, but they are providing a lot of information through a platform and through an application that could be insecure. So, you know, before they got as large, I mean, I think they've grown something like, you know, at least 500 or 600% over the last year. But as they were launching the application, we got involved with the design phase and like a secure code review of the mobile application and how it's going about providing that information to those backend services in a secure manner. We were able to identify a couple of severe issues with platform or, you know, personal information that was being stored on the device in a, you know, in a suspicious manner, and help them actually secure that that data and do it correctly so that it wouldn't expose consumers to undue risk. So that's one that we've done within the last year. And, you know, we go back and we help them as they're launching new features as well on a yearly basis to make sure that they, you know, they are still handling that data securely, and that there isn't anything that's popped up in recent builds and in recent pushes to that would expose the consumers and expose that information. So that's Carvana. That's one good success story that we've had actually working with a customer. So.
Excellent. Sounds awesome. Now let's go to the cyber. Let's segue now into the cybersecurity industry here in general. Personally, you as a cybersecurity specialist, where do you go for like application security news and research? For me, as a tech writer, for example, when a client wants me to write something like on phishing or pen testing, I just do a Google search. What's pen testing? I look at the tools. But are there certain search parameters that you use, or are there any other search engines that you do, or do you have like any favorite websites that you always go to? Can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah. Let's talk through that, right? Like, one of the resources, probably the largest application security specific resource right now is OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project. If you've heard of OWASP before, the OWASP Top 10, Robbie?
Oh, yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So that's the OWASP.org is kind of the largest nonprofit that's out there that's focused on application security. And obviously, in the name is web application security. A lot of the frameworks and, you know, tools that they provide aren't necessarily specific to web application security, but that's how they got their start. And that was about, probably would have been 15 years ago or whatever that they were founded. I don't know the exact date. But that's the kind of the initial point. That's the one that everybody knows about because of the OWASP top 10 application or web application risks that are out there. That top 10 list has been codified by a number of compliance organizations. So you'll find it in things like SOX and PCI. Even though that's not necessarily what OWASP was going for, but it's kind of like a nice succinct list as far as, hey, you have an application, it's new, you want to develop it, what are the things that you need to be worried about? And they do go about updating that list every 3 years. So that's kind of the first thing for application security. That's the first place that I would look. They have conferences that they run annually, right? There's Global AppSec DC that's actually next week in, you know, Washington, D.C. A couple weeks out is one in Amsterdam, Global AppSec Amsterdam. So they run the AppSec conferences. And then there's also local meetups associated with that. So there's like a OWASP Salt Lake City group or, OWASP Phoenix group all over the country, the big cities. There's usually a group that gets together and talks about application security topics. That's a good place to go to actually meet people to figure out what's going on. Now, that's a lot of kind of like meet space. You've got to go talk to people and visit with people. The other place that it seems that the security industry lives is on Twitter. I know that Twitter, like social media, gets a little weird. So they do a little bit on LinkedIn, but most of the new and upcoming research, the new vulnerabilities that are being released, new approaches for testing, new approaches for securing applications. That research is being touted on Twitter, and there's a number of, for lack of a better term, popular Twitter accounts that you can follow that are associated with that, right? And that's where I'd recommend that people getting into the industry or that are interested in it, that's what they turn to first, right? Go look at OWASP, go follow like the OWASP Twitter page. There's also like the Burke Suite, James Kettle that's over there that does a lot of Burp Suite is an application proxy that it can be used for testing applications, but they do a lot of cutting edge research as well. Those are the places that I would turn to as well. Obviously, Google search engines, but if you're following Twitter accounts, a lot of the posts that come out, they'll be posted on Medium or on personal blog, something like that. I haven't found a great aggregator of application security topics and news. You can always get onto Reddit and follow like rnetsec, and they'll pop up application security topics in there. And at times they're applicable, but at times they swing over to more network security because it is NetSec. But there is a lot of security news that pops in there. As far as like aggregation goes, you'll see the hot application security topics pop up there as well. What else am I thinking of? The conferences themselves, right? So your local B-Sides conferences, I didn't bring those up as well. Those happen all over the world. So if you can't make it to Black Hat and DEF CON, those large security conferences in Vegas every year, find the local OWASP meetup and then find your local B-Sides events because the application security people are typically there and talking about applications, what they're doing, what the new research is. Sometimes they've got very targeted kind of beginner classes as well. So they'll teach you about how to go assess a web application, look for the OWASP top 10 risks. That's a good place to start if you're getting into the industry, but then there usually are some more advanced topics in the talk tracks as well. So I think that's probably where I go traditionally. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize there were so many new services out there like that just for app security. But now, can you recommend any conferences for other people in our audience that might be application developers like yourself? I know you've gone to Black Hat, DEF CON, but are there any others that are worth going to or spending money on?
There definitely is, right? So I kind of mentioned the free ones, OWASP is that those global AppSec conferences that I mentioned are pretty good if you want to go and kind of get a broader feel for the industry. I, personally, as a developer, I'm a big fan of the developer conferences, right? And finding the security tracks that are there. AWS reInvent, for example, where everything is moving to the cloud. They have great security tracks associated with those big developer conferences. So it's great to go to the security conferences and learn how to, do their capture the flag events and learn how to hack different things. But from an actual application security perspective, and I have to protect my application, I don't find those as useful as I do things like AWS reInvent, where I'm actually going and learning how people are building applications and what the controls that exist within that application are. Your Java conferences, Python conference that happens every year. That is a great place to go and actually learn about, number one, Python and, what Python is about, the language itself. But there are great security tracks and security features that people are coming together to talk about that actually influence the security of your application way more than what you're going to learn at a security conference like DEF CON. DEF CON is going to be fun, and you're going to learn how to break applications, and you're going to see this cutting-edge research. But a lot of the talks are very specific to, hey, I found this one vulnerability in this one version of a framework, and I was able to exploit it to take over, somebody's AWS instance. And that's great, but they've already disclosed that. They've already fixed it. The vendor has, and so it has to be patched. But that doesn't actually help you as a developer when you're trying to secure your application. It's more of it almost feels like a presentation that's about something that's happened in the past that's more about fun, more about, hacking approaches than it is about securing what you currently have.
Okay, excellent. Now, what is, in your view, what is the most important component or piece of the software security puzzle?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's so much information that's out there. If you go and you Google, right, or you use a search engine to look for software security in your framework or language, most of what's going to be pop up is going to be people having problems with it. So you'll find like Stack Overflow items about security with the .NET Core framework, right? If we take that as an example. But it's not going to actually tell you how to go about building a security program. We kind of talked about that SDLC and the offerings that Redpoint has around building secure software. Obviously, if you're doing that internal to an organization, you're going to have somebody that is responsible for that process. So somebody on your security team that's application focused. But if they're coming into something blind, I would almost say that the most important piece of that puzzle is the people that you have. That it's not necessarily the technology. There's no silver bullet. There's no like one thing that you can do that's going to eliminate, all of your software security risks. I recently had a discussion. I'm trying to remember who it was, but this came up, right? We were talking about, threat modeling and figuring out what the risks and that people want to be 100% secure. And the only way to be 100% secure is, first of all, to unplug all of your servers, right, your applications, and fire all your people. And that's the only way that you can be 100% secure in anything. So when it comes down to what the most important piece of a software security puzzle is or building a software security program, it's the people that you have involved and the relationships that they have with people that have influence over that SDLC process. So as an application security person, I'm looking to build out a security program. My first 3 months are not going to be, hey, I'm going to push down all of this process around, building applications and try to, create some infrastructure that tests every piece of software that's coming out of the development organization. My first 3 months are going to be invested in finding out who the players are, building relationships with the different players in the organization. That includes the development staff, the guys that are actually cutting the code on a daily basis. Because if they don't trust you and what you're telling them, they're not going to implement it, right? Like if you're affecting how long it takes for them to build their software and get their job done, and you're just a bottleneck in that, they're not actually going to help you out in securing that software pipeline. And so you've got to build, relationships with them. You've got to build relationships with their managers, with the C-level executives, so they understand what the threats are and the risks are of not actually building software or building security into the software that's being produced by that organization. There's a lot of examples out there of, hey, what happens when something goes wrong, right? When, you've got your, Target way back in the day, but even, every day it seems like there's another breach that's associated with some sort of software failure. And so you've got to be able to make that case, but you've got to build the relationships with all the different people in that pipeline. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to secure that software. And it may take a long time to build those relationships and chip away at the view that people have of security in general. But that's where coming in as a developer and as someone that actually understands codes helps, because there's, you can help that antagonistic relationship that typically exists between development and security, or business and security, where security is this agent of no. Nobody wants their application to end up in the news, right? They don't want their company to end up in the news because of something that they wrote. And you want to come in as, hey, guess what? I'm going to help you be the best case in that scenario and not the worst case. So that's where I'd go. I would say that the most important thing about, software security and building a software security program or that software security puzzle is, the people that you have involved, not necessarily a technology for a specific offering.
Okay, sounds great. Now, if an organization doesn't have one, how should they start with an application security program? Are there methodologies like open source platforms that they can just adopt quickly, or what do you recommend?
Yeah, I would be turning initially to OWASP, right, and seeing what they've got, right? They have a number. So, obviously you could partner with somebody like Redpoint to help you build out that program. And finding that first person that is focused on software security is great. But I would come at it very similar to what I did about that software security puzzle, is it's the people first and the technology comes after that. I would turn, first of all, find someone in your organization that's already familiar with the organization and make them your application security person. And it doesn't really matter if they're super technical, right? Like if it's a developer, that's great. But it also means that there should be like some sort of management support that is there for building out that application security program. You can always go to OWASP and pull down, their guides on, hey, you want to do threat modeling, you want to have these different pieces in place to build an application security program. And you can use those as a framework for this is how we're going to deploy. But the first thing that you've got to do is have that person that's responsible for it that can drive it and understands the organization and how they would go about. I've seen multiple organizations fail by going out into the marketplace first off and just picking up somebody that's very popular or someone that is, that's made a name on the security space and saying, hey, these guys were very good at finding vulnerabilities in a bug bounty, so they must know how to build a security program or an application security program. And what happens is they come in and the first thing they want to do is go find all the bugs in the application itself, which is great, but that doesn't actually equate to building an application security program because that's so focused on an application that's already been developed, vulnerabilities that already exist, while you've got the developers that are sitting over here on the other side of this application security or this application development program that are churning out more and more vulnerabilities or anything else. So finding that person that actually understands the whole SDLC process, and this can be, like I said, somebody that comes out from your development team. You could turn that whole development team into an application security team because they understand what's going on within the organization, and then train them up to be application security experts. The reason that Redpoint has gone that route as well is that the developers that understand how an application is built, they make the best application security experts because they understand how the application is built. And an organization should go about it the same way, right? We already have this team of developers that is somewhat geared towards security. Maybe they wrote your authentication routines. Maybe they're the ones that are responsible for, DevOps and actually deploying things securely into the cloud. Let's attach security to that team instead of pulling in an outsider that doesn't understand what's going on. It's going to take them a while to ramp up, and you will be in a better place when it comes down to it and when you actually have built that program out. Does that make sense, Robbie?
It makes perfect sense. I don't have much of a software development background. I think I did some work in the last decade when I had my first business, I was trying to teach myself Java, and I think the only part where I got to was actually like creating a little window, and I got so excited when I did that, and after that I really haven't spent too much time with software development. That's kind of where I'm lacking. But I think in my next book on AI, there's going to be a lot of code in Python. We'll be showing some examples of artificial intelligence. I think my co-author is much better versed in the Python programming language than I am. So he's going to be writing some sample code. I've been told that Python's like the biggest, like the de facto programming language for artificial intelligence and cybersecurity. And in fact, I'm probably going to be getting a book. One of my friends recommended to me, it's like how to teach your kid Python or something. He sent me the text image. I'm probably going to just go on Amazon and buy that, but he said that's where a lot of people get started. So I really need to learn some software development, but unfortunately I just haven't taught myself anything. I don't think I have the mindset for that. I think it takes a different kind of mindset, and I just don't have it. I was actually hired on, believe it or not, right after my MBA. I got that in Management Information Systems, Computer Science. And I was actually hired to do, like, mainframe COBOL programming at the time, and I just didn't understand anything, how to write code. It was just so above me, you know. But anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's kind of where I'm at. Huh?
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, it definitely seems to be a – there are people that really love to pull things apart, right? Like, and figure out how they're built and then put them back together. I'm always surprised at, you know, who it is that actually, you know, seems to have that knack. I know when I initially did school as well, it was like, oh, I don't know if I can go about being a developer full time, right? That was never really in my roadmap. It was, hey, I'm going to go be a developer and we'll see where this takes us. And it's been great that, like, the application security stuff has come about. And in the last couple of years, I find that I actually have spent more time doing development efforts. And as far as Python goes, I would totally agree with what your co-author is saying. Python is the problem is, like, with you starting software development, Java, like, it's a computer science. It's a great place to do, like, computer science-y stuff, but it doesn't lend itself well to actually learning to code. There's a lot of like Python is way better at that than Java ever
Seriously.
Was.
Seriously, okay. I didn't know that. I thought that Java was like the most widely used for like developing web applications and all that. But what do I know about software development? I just don't know.
Yeah, you're right. I think because it's been around for so long, Java is like it backs a lot of the internet as we know it. But it's not the easiest language to actually learn how to code, to learn how to develop algorithms, to actually to learn about software engineering, I wouldn't push someone towards Java first anymore. I'd push them towards Python, like you're saying. And in the software industry or the security industry, we use Python all the time, right? Like I see a lot of applications. Yes. Yeah. A lot of applications written in Python specific to analyzing an application or scanning the internet or, you know, doing anything because it is so easy to actually use. Python and Go are actually the two languages that I'm seeing quite a bit of tooling and security tooling around. So if you want to, you know, if you want to get into the industry, those are the places to actually do it. And I know with like ML and other things too, and, you know, data analytics, Python is huge. So, you know, if someone's interested in that, the PyCon conference, that Python conference is awesome. Right?
Oh.
That's a great place to go.
What is that Python class? Has it already come and gone, or is it still coming? Or
Let's see where it's at this year. Let's see. I think it's already done. It's usually in the spring. But they have national conferences. So there's PyCon US. It's April. So April 15th through the 23rd this year or next year in Pennsylvania. And then they have like a European conference as well. So PyCon EU or PyCon, you know, Brazil. Yeah. Yeah. We just missed the EuroPython. That one's July 8th through the 14th. That was earlier this summer. But the one that's in the spring is a good one to go to, and it's very much it's run by like PyCon as a charitable organization, and they just so they try to keep the costs down so that developers can get there and actually learn. But you know, my first foray into like data analytics stuff was all associated with PyCon. Like I went and I talked about data security. You know, building secure Python applications at PyCon 1 year, but like I had a great time going and seeing the other talks, the other approaches that, hey, they're building something interesting in, you know, in Python itself. So.
Excellent. Now, let's just a few more questions on the cybersecurity threat landscape in general, if you don't mind. Now, I mean, as a writer, I've been writing numerous blogs and holding the C-suite more accountable. You know, this is a hot and growing trend now here. I mean, it's like the CISO's or the CIO's head should roll, but my opinion is that, you know, don't shoot from the hip first, see what exactly happens, and then decide who's ultimately responsible, where the fault lay at, then take the actions. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, should a CIO or CISO should be fired just on the spot once they've been hit, or what's your philosophy on that?
I think they so – okay, so that's an interesting question because I go back and forth with it, right? I think they need to be held responsible, yes, but I don't think they need to be fired on the spot. The issue that I see in the industry coming up from like the security teams themselves is that we're very bad at pointing the finger, right? So one of these breaches happened, and it's like everybody freaks out and they're like, oh, look, you know, they did everything wrong. Like, so if we talk about the Capital One breach that recently happened, the initial reactions to it are so severe and so kind of shaming, even though the way that the breach happened is totally understandable. If you've ever looked at an organization that is a large, like financial organization, they have a number of controls, they have a number of things that are in place, and something got misconfigured. It wasn't like they, you know, just exposed all this data. It was somebody with insider knowledge. It was somebody that, you know, figured out that the application had this one flaw and that there was this one role that gave them access to things that they probably shouldn't have access to, but were able to enumerate a whole bunch of data, and it took a long time. So there was a number of different failures that had to happen for the breach to actually be exposed. I would be disappointed in Capital One if they went and they like fired their CISO straight out. It's almost like the guy that learned the lesson is more valuable to them than somebody off the street that's going to come in and try and tell them what to do, right? So I think they need to be held responsible, and they probably need to come out and talk about it and what actually happened. What I would prefer to see is, instead of firing them outright, is I would prefer to see them actually lay out what happened so that everyone else in the community can learn and get better. That's where we do a really poor job is, you know, we turn around and as an industry itself, we're guilty of this. Is the first thing we do is they get breached, the Capital One gets breached. I turn around and I look at my stuff as a security professional. I'm like, okay, did we get breached? No, we're good. And then I get on Twitter and I get all like high and mighty about how Capital One is bad and we're the best, which is just not helpful, right? All we're doing is we're shaming them for having a problem that we probably know could happen to us tomorrow, but because it didn't happen to us, we're shaming someone else for it, right? Rather than looking at what happened to them and taking those lessons and learning from them, and actually having some sort of information sharing going on about the vulnerabilities, about the breaches, about everything that's happened. So, like, I want them to be held accountable, but most of the time, the vulnerabilities and the breaches themselves are not necessarily due to a, you know, like a huge negligence on the part of the C-suite. If it is, then definitely there should be some accounting and some reworking that needs to happen. But most of the time, it's something within the organization and the structure itself that actually caused the breach or was the result of that breach.
Okay. Interesting viewpoint. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to ask, how has everybody else responded to that?
It's mixed. I've interviewed probably 40 or 50, you know, just strictly C-level cybersecurity executives. They may not all be C-level, but, you know, they're at least, you know, manager, owner, or higher up with titles. They're split. They say, yeah, the CISO's head should roll, or, yeah, they should need to take a more holistic view. So it's interesting. That's why I asked that question. I guess everybody has their own view. My view is more holistic. You know, first and foremost, get everything back up and running. Take care of your customers that have been impacted. And then figure out who's responsible. Really, in my opinion, that's like the last part that needs to be addressed. I mean, yes, somebody should be held responsible. Ultimately, it's a cyber attacker to be brought to justice, but we know how, you know, slow things are here to, you know, to extradite somebody from a foreign country or bring someone to trial. I mean, now we're just seeing, you know, cyber attackers now being put in jail or fined heavily for, you know, attacks from years ago. So, but, you know, that's a whole different realm of cybersecurity, you know, the law and all that. So, anyway, another thing I have here is, you know, we keep hearing about nation-state threat actors, North Korea, China, you know, every day when I look through news, there's always something about China or Facebook. I mean, seriously, there does not go by a day without something on that. What are your thoughts on like, these nation-state threat actors? I'm not trying to get political here, but, you know, do you have any thoughts on that? Or?
Yeah, it's always a discussion that comes up, right, with clients, and especially when we start talking about application risks, right? So one of the activities that we do for applications, you know, during that design architecture phase is what we call threat modeling. Right. So we're looking at the application. We're looking at the different threat actors that would be coming in to attack that application. You got things like malicious users and others. But one of the items that's always on that as a threat actor is a nation state actor. Right. So China, Russia specifically, the different teams that they have that are looking at applications that are trying to get information about, you know, consumers or whatever else it is. The problem that we have is that it is so incredibly difficult to protect against like that sustained level of effort in exploiting an application or getting access to consumer data. So if I go back to the Experian breach, all of this data has been exposed somehow and was taken by someone, but we've never seen that actually show up on the dark web. Like other breaches, right? Like usually when there's some sort of criminal organization that's there, what they do is they suck it up and then they're trying to sell it on the dark web to make more money off of it to people that'll, you know, go and do, you know, identity theft or whatever else, right? To make money off of that data itself. A nation state, however, doesn't necessarily have that same viewpoint. So that the kind of common thread that I'm hearing from researchers and from people in the industry is that most likely that Experian breach got sucked up by a nation state that is using that data as like a data mining utility, right? So they've captured it all somewhere and they can target specific people, specific, you know, places in the U.S. based on the data that they were able to get. And so protecting against a nation state actor is just so incredibly difficult that I don't know if a small business, especially, it's not something that they're going to be able to put the money into. Right? Larger businesses, larger Fortune 500s will definitely have that as, hey, guess what? We need to make sure that our data is not being leaked to Russia and China. Right? Just in general. So there's things that they can do and they can limit the access that's coming from those countries, but there's always ways around any of that. It's kind of this arms race that is constantly happening. And we're still in the Wild West when it comes down to it on the internet itself. There's so much data that's being transferred around. There's so many parties that are involved. Those large organizations, I definitely have to take into account who they give their data to and how secure those third parties are. We see a lot of third-party risk assessments happening, and you know it's hard to know where your data as a consumer has actually ended up, right? How many consumers actually knew who Experian was before the breach happened? I would argue probably the majority did not. So, like being scared of China and Russia is one thing, but I like as a consumer, I'm like, hey, guess what? In your daily life, you're probably not being targeted directly. As a large organization, yes, you have to take that into account. And there's things that you're going to have to do, and there's money that you're going to have to spend that probably a small organization doesn't have to worry about.
Okay. Interesting viewpoint. Now, the cyber threat landscape is changing, you know, dynamically from a software development security standpoint. It's always changing, too. How do you foresee a threat landscape evolving in the coming years? What do you think the next biggest threat's going to be? I guess let's say going into 2020, now that we only have, like, what, 4 months left of the year, or 3.5 months, what do you think the next big threat's going to be next year?
Yeah. That's a hard one. You want me to pull out my crystal ball? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, that'd be great.
If I could answer, if I could answer that question, I'd be in. Anyway.
Well, we'd all be right, but anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. So, it's really hard to say. I definitely feel like there's a lot of data aggregation that's going on. Like I was talking about with the nation state stuff, that people are, pulling all this information together. I think the person that can figure out how to secure people's data so that it's only accessible by organizations that people know about are going to be very successful in the future. But it's a very difficult problem to solve. I mean, you've got like all the AI stuff that's popping up, and I think that's going to drive security in general. The book that you're talking about, it all becomes very interesting because we're starting to trust computers to make more and more decisions. Even AI around self-driving cars and other things like that. Like there's the whole aspect of actually being able to drive and recognize people and other things, but there's also the ability to, do dangerous things with that. So as we trust computers and AI to make more and more decisions in kind of the physical world, I think that's where the threat is starting to pop up more and more, right? We've always had this, the SCA or ICS, like the industrial control systems that are out there that run things like, nuclear power plants and electrical grids and everything like that. And as that comes online, it becomes a bigger threat to more people. So I think that it'll move from, hey, I've got this one or two vulnerabilities that allow me to get at X number of people, like a small number of people, to the larger system that affect more and more people, that it will be there's going to be a seismic shift there that happens. That those systems that control more online or more physical devices, right, or physical controls are going to be attacked more and more. So, and the same thing can go, right? Next year we have an election year here in the U.S., right? There's a lot of weaknesses with the election security and those devices themselves that could be an issue. But I also think influencing people somehow through other mechanisms is we've already seen that happen within Facebook and other things. So I know I'm kind of wandering over topics, but I do feel like the more that you can approach the physical world, the more security becomes important. And that's where people will start targeting. Right? If I can get money out, if I can actually influence people, if I can, if I can lock up their computer and they pay me money, all that kind of stuff, or I can So I guess there's one thing there, but that's where I feel like it's going. The more it's the physical world, the more it addresses the physical world and they can take advantage of it, that's going to be where malicious actors look.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, one question I always ask my podcast guests is that, apart from, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, insurance, and so forth, another hot area that I've been writing about and reading about is the Internet of Things, the IoT. Personally, I don't like it myself because I just can't stand all this interconnectedness. I just think it's just increasing the surface attack or the attack surface for the cyber attacker, 20-fold. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Are you a fan of it? Do you like it? Or what do you think?
I think it's inevitable. Because people want convenience, right? So I think it's inevitable. I don't necessarily like the way that it's gone because it's a race to the bottom, and security was never the first thought were never in the discussion until devices started to be released. So, you know, one of the villages that's at DEF CON is the Internet of Things Village, where they just bring in internet-connected devices and rip them apart to look at, like, how they're secured. And it's consistently, I mean, it's fun to go in and play with the devices, but, like, the security is so poor on a lot of those because they're just being pushed out the door as quickly as possible. Like, you know, you've got, like, some internet-connected light bulb that people are attaching to their internal network and then allowing to go out to the internet to get updates, and it's just another, like you said, it's the attack surface that is expanded. As a security industry and as a tech industry, we haven't educated people on how these devices need to be used, right? We're telling them, oh, it just connects to your Wi-Fi and it's fine. That's not the case, right? They are insecure. They typically, you know, some organizations do a really good job at locking that down or putting money into security and make sure that they're not being compromised. But there's others that are sending the data, like it's communicating with, you know, China and like some server there to get the updates. And you have no idea what it's actually doing on the network besides sending traffic out all the time. So, like, I don't like it, but I think it's inevitable. And we've got to get our heads around ways to secure that, that reduce the risk to general consumers while maintaining some level of usability. Because people aren't taking that stuff back. They're plugging it in, they're using it. You know, they love to change the color of their lights in their living room from their phone, right? And so it's not going to go away. And then, you know, they also like to be able to tell Alexa or, you know, Siri, hey, do this for me, while they're sitting in the comfort of their living room. And you understand that that makes their lives easier, but it makes our lives harder as security people because of the malicious actors and the different avenues that those consumers are opening up. Initially when I worked at the bank, that was one of the things that we had a problem with is Wi-Fi, right? People wanted to be mobile with their laptops, and the bank was having a hard time figuring out how to secure it. And so they're like, okay, we're not going to deploy anything yet. And we had people like tellers that would bring in like devices that they had bought at, you know, Circuit City or Best Buy at the time, and they would just plug them into the network. And they would just open up the network, like the bank's internal like network of teller machines, to anyone that was walking by that happened to see that connection was open. Right? And that's the same. That's kind of the same place that we're in with IoT devices right now. People are like, hey, this is great. This seems very convenient. So I'm just going to plug it into my internal network and go. As corporations, we've done a better job of locking that down. Like, we don't allow those devices, or we don't allow unauthenticated things onto our internal networks. But consumer devices and consumer networks are completely wide open. So I don't like it, but it's going to happen. So we got to figure out how to secure it. Basically, my takeaway there.
Well, I know the only security mechanism that has really been taken seriously is that California passed a IoT law, I think, in January, or they signed into legislation, but it's so vague. And I know that the vendors, they really don't care about security. They just want to get the products out there and obviously make their sales. You know, they don't really seem to care too much about it. They just have these minimal threshold settings. They don't tell the customer, hey, you know, you got to fit this to your own security requirements, do an audit, you know, do a sandbox test first. They just don't do that. So anyway, well, Seth, as we come close now to wrapping up the show, there's just one final question I want to ask you. I ask this, and I get this asked a lot in return. What is your laundry list, your top 5-6 items or what have you, that you recommend that you recommend people or businesses to protect themselves from a cyber attack?
Okay, so my laundry list, number one, practice what you preach, first of all, right? Like, I mean, it always goes back to kind of the people. People are kind of the weakest links, and that goes with C-level executives. That goes with security people in general. That goes with everyone that's there. So, you know, enable, 2FA, right, or multi-factor authentication on all of your important accounts. Right, as a business, right, like make sure that AWS is, you know, using multi-factor authentication because it limits your risk. Make sure that your password policies are secure, right? Like, so let's do away with those, simple 6-character passwords, password 123, make sure that you're not using the same password on across all accounts, right? There's things that you can do. If you make sure that you are secure first, that's going to naturally bleed into everything else that you do. Once you feel like you're at some level of security with your own devices, educate the others that are around you, right? So if you see someone with a post-it note of their password on there, let's have a discussion about that. So I always go back to kind of relationships and that people are the most insecure link in that chain. So it's very good to have technical control, but all it takes is one administrator to actually, share their password or get exposed, and all of a sudden, all that security is done away with because people can jump through those technical hoops. From an application security perspective, then I would start going into, the OWASP Top 10, make sure that your developers are trained on security and they know what security issues that are out there. And then from an organizational perspective, I'd make sure that, you've got a good information security policy and people know what it is, and that they are consistently being pushed on that, right? Like whether that's, phishing exercises that, people, don't click on links in emails. You want to make sure that they don't do that. And if they do, they're at least educated about it and what's going on and why they shouldn't. So first off, I'd make sure that you yourself are secure. If you're using MFA, you're using secure passwords, and then I would start pushing into training other people and like making sure that the technical controls exist for you to actually keep your organization or yourself secure.
Okay. Well, Seth, we thank you very much for your time this weekend. We really enjoyed having you and your insight into application security. We look forward to having you again on future shows.
Yeah, thanks, Shabby. It was a fun conversation. And yeah, hopefully if anything else pops up, let me know. But yeah, I'd love to come back on sometime.
It sounds awesome. Take care. Have a great rest of the weekend.
You too. Thanks, Shabby. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.